This is Functional Medicine Update for March 2008, Volume 28, Number 3. In this month's edition, we will concern ourselves with the subject of metabolic syndrome and functional dermatology. Our topics will include the role of lipoproteins beyond cardiology, the complexity of HDL, the ratio of ApoB to ApoA1, the plaques test, diet and lifestyle intervention, and the tracking of a patient's progress. And our interview this month is with Dr. Valerie Treloar, discussing functional dermatology. We will conclude this issue with some thoughts on the use of pre- and probiotics for Crohn's disease and other conditions. Now here's Dr. Jeffrey Bland and this edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Well, welcome to Functional Medicine Update for March 2008. I have a real treat in store for you this month in that we're going to have the opportunity to speak about the dermatological implications of functional medicine with an expert functional medicine practitioner, Dr. Valerie Treloar, who is a board-certified dermatologist and a functional medicine practitioner. And she's going to talk about the relationships of functional matrix-related assessment for dermatological conditions. And I think you're going to find this fascinating because we know the skin is one of those very important places to do overall assessment of physiological health status. Certainly in nutrition, we learn early on how to use the skin as a way of assessing certain things such as petechia formation with hemorrhagic problems or with chylosis, or looking at the nose as an indication for B vitamin sufficiency, or looking at skin lesions that have to do with dermatitis such as gluten sensitivity. So the skin becomes a very, very valuable tool for doing kind of a systemic run-through of factors of the immune system and nutritional status. And you're going to hear much more about that as this has evolved beautifully with Dr. Treloar and her concepts. To get there, however, let me talk once again about how signals are established in the body that ultimately weave themselves into physiologic function. And I think that one of the things that we recognize is that we often use in medicine surrogate markers for evaluating what we consider the flame of the fire that's going on at the physiologic level. We look at the smoke, and then we try to, from the smoke, which are the surrogate markers, define what the flame looks like, i.e. the pathology. And there are many, many different markers that we use in medicine to try to evaluate or at least get some insight into what's going on. Some of those are related to lipid-related functions and lipid analyses. These become early warning assessment tools for cardiovascular disease risk and other functional problems related to alterations in the web of physiology. And so let me, if I can, talk about the focus on lipoproteins for a second. And as you probably recall, the development of understanding of lipoproteins has been a major breakthrough in functional cardiology. And now it turns out it relates to many other factors of an endocrine nature and to an inflammatory nature and an immunological nature. Other than just being owned by cardiology itself, we start to see lipoproteins being surrogate markers for many different distortions in physiologic function. Let's talk about the HDL, LDL, VLDL, IDL type of nomenclature. This has to do with density of various lipoproteins in centrifugation. As you probably recall, when they were first developed by ultracentrifugation, you could get these various bands in lipid patterns that were related to a certain density of materials. We know that fats don't dissolve in blood well because fats and water don't dissolve, so they have to be transported in the body by detergent-like molecules that we call apolipoproteins. And these apolipoproteins have names like A, B, C, D, and E. These apolipoproteins are synthesized in the liver generally by signals that occur from outside the body and inside the body that stimulate upregulation of the genes that express the formation of these proteins, at least the messenger RNA that later become these proteins, which then encode the names of ApoA, B, C, D, and E. And there are subcategories under each one of those big families of apolipoproteins. Each one of those apolipoproteins, when synthesized in the liver, carries different composition of various transport lipids. This could be different distributions of long chain, medium chain, and short chain fatty acids, and triglyceride remnants and particles and other fat-soluble molecules, and these are all bound together in these lipoprotein particles that have different densities, that therefore they are given the names as IDL, HDL, VLDL. And so what we have found over the years is that certain of these particles are associated with increasing risk of disease, and others appear to be associated with decreasing risk of disease. And that's where the good cholesterol, bad cholesterol nomenclature emerged. LDL, the low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, being associated with particles that appear to have greater atherogenicity, or at least be associated with the atherogenic process, whereas those that are associated with HDL appear to be anti-atherogenic and are involved with cholesterol efflux, meaning cholesterol moving out of the artery wall. We had a wonderful discussion of that in our Functional Medicine Update Clinician Researcher of the Month interview with Dr. Roger Newton, who told us a tremendous amount about the HDL particle. And so we started to see an increasing focus on HDL lipoproteins and their ability to be associated with reduction of cardiovascular risk. But we recognize that these particles, be it HDL, LDL, or VDL, don't just occur spontaneously in the blood. They're, as I mentioned, synthesized or manufactured in the liver from other signals that can be endocrine-related signals or immune-related signals or inflammatory-related signals. So they reflect then a state of function of the whole body. And so as a person changes their physiological state function, their lipoproteins can change. Now, you know that, right? This is a rule of reasonableness with women who undergo the menopause, that often their blood lipids change, their cholesterol goes up, and their cholesterol goes up not suddenly because they started eating a higher cholesterol and fat diet, but because the synthesis of their apolipoproteins changed upon reduction of ovarian estrogen secretion and altered androgen-estrogen levels, which then triggers the liver to manufacture different apolipoproteins that transports lipids like cholesterol in different ways out of the liver into the systemic circulation. So we recognize that it's not just putting a woman solely on a fat-restricted diet that will modify their atherogenic dyslipidemia, but rather it's to regulate the signals that associate themselves with the proper construction of these transport molecules, as well as cholesterol biosynthesis and triglyceride biosynthesis. So it's much more complex than just fat restriction. We're talking about endocrine-related signaling that regulates the production of these lipoproteins that take fats out of the liver into the blood. We also know that stress hormones affect this as well. So that's why you often see people under stress have differing lipoprotein levels in their blood and different serum lipids. So you can have a person that's had a high immediate stress and their triglycerides might go up, even though they didn't eat a high-fat meal. This was shown in a study that was published in The Lancet many years ago in the early 70s with Le Mans race car drivers that during the course of the 24-hour race, their serum triglyceride levels went up, even though they weren't eating. And it took several weeks after the race for them to come back down into normal range because they were actually under stress hormone modulation, producing different transport molecules to bring lipids out of the liver into the blood. And you might say, well, why does their body do that? There could be some evolutionary benefit to that if these are stress response to try to feed cells with energy, right? Energy are these lipids, these fat molecules like triglycerides that can in fact be used as a source of metabolic fuel. So all of this kind of feeds together with the recognition that when we're examining these markers that we call lipoproteins in the blood, we're examining very complex factors related to endocrine, immune, inflammatory, environmental response. Even xenobiotic exposures can alter serum lipid levels and can induce hepatic changes in lipid biosynthesis. Now, with regard to the HDL particle, an understanding of the metabolism and biological actions of HDL is really starting to emerge very beautifully. And I think Roger Newton's wonderful paper that he published in Atherosclerosis Supplements back in 2002 related to HDL therapy for acute treatment of atherosclerosis, and the current understanding of the metabolism and biological actions of HDL has helped point us in the right direction as to how important this lipoprotein is in signaling antioxidation and proper lipid transport. We now know from the work of Jay Heineke and his colleagues at the University of Washington School of Medicine that the HDL particle is the most sophisticated of the lipoprotein particles in that it contains some 42 different proteins. And these proteins are involved with the lipid metabolism. Some of these proteins are proteinase inhibitors. Some are acute phase response proteins. and others have complement regulation. They all then have a functional component. So the HDL is more than just a particle that transports fat and pulls cholesterol and triglycerides out of the artery wall. It has a very dramatic influence on signaling processes by docking to receptor sites for the HDL on the surface of cells and signaling through the composition of these proteins, specific types of activity. So within the HDL lipoprotein, you have ApoE, for instance. You can have ApoE 2, 3, or 4, and we know that depending upon the genetics of the ApoE configuration, you might have a differing relative risk. ApoE 4 double alleles, we associate it with increasing risk of cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's dementia, whereas ApoE 2, 3 variations are lower risk categories, and people that got the conferred benefit of a double ApoE 2 haplotype are those that seem to have longevity genes. This is because the ApoE has an effect on cellular antioxidation. So the HDL particle is actually seen as an antioxidant particle in some extent. It also has enzymes like myeloperoxidase within the composition of the HDL particle, and that has its effects then on serving as part of the body's immune defense system and part of the redox pathway of the body. So what I'm trying to get you to understand is that these lipoproteins are more than just transport for fat. They have functional characteristics that are regulating at peripheral cellular sites many different functions that regulate gene expression patterns in those cells. And based on the composition of the apolipoproteins, which is in fact related to the stimulation of gene expression for their synthesis through the endocrine, nervous, and immune systems, you can alter not just only the transport of fat from the liver to the blood, but also the effect that those apolipoproteins have on peripheral cellular sites serving as functional characteristics. So we know that this is a genes and environment question again. If you're conferred with the genetic luck of the draw and you get the melanoprotein ApoA1 configuration, then you have a very low HDL, but you have a very low incidence of cardiovascular disease because these melanoA protein mutations confer a reduced risk of oxidative injury and inflammatory-induced atherogenesis. If, however, you have the wild-type ApoA1, ApoA1 is part of the HDL particle that helps to pull lipids out of the artery wall. So you want your ApoA1 levels to be high, and you want your apolipoprotein capital B levels to be low, because apolipoprotein B is the principal apolipoprotein associated with LDL atherogenic particles and the delivery of fat into the artery wall, cholesterol and triglyceride. So you want your ApoB to be low, your A1 to be high, which then leads us into a recognition that the ApoB to A1 ratio is a very important risk factor determinant for atherogenicity and cardiometabolic syndrome. And the ApoB to A1 ratio, when it gets above 0.6 to 1, and you can have the laboratory measure ApoB and A1, and if that number, that quotient is greater than 0.6 to 1, when ApoB is divided by A1 levels, then it's associated with increasing relative risk. When you get up to 0.8, it's almost double the relative risk to cardiovascular disease. So you want your ApoB to A1 ratio to be below 0.6 to 1. And diet and lifestyle intervention plays a very big role in lowering the ApoB to A1 ratio. In fact, work of Dr. Catherine Esposito, as she describes in a recent issue of Arterial Sclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology, talks about optimal treatments for metabolic syndrome and cardiometabolic syndrome, and points out that on altering the ApoB to A1 ratio, lowering the ApoB to A1 ratio, and that it also increases the activity of peroxidase, PON1 as it's abbreviated, PON1, which is an antioxidant enzyme within the HDL particle. So you get increased antioxidant activity by the intervention with Mediterranean diet, which lowers the ApoB and increases the ApoA1 component. And you get reduction of myeloperoxidase-induced oxidation. So that has a positive benefit as well through the intervention with Mediterranean diet. Now, what's my takeaway to this? My takeaway is that diet has a much more profound influence as altering cellular signaling than just delivering lipid or delivering protein or carbohydrate. The information molecules within the diet, particularly in a complex diet like the Mediterranean diet that's rich in fruits, nuts, berries, and vegetables that have different phytochemical compositions that influence gene expression, that rich, varied diet then influences intracellular signal transduction in such a way as to induce or encourage proper lipoprotein composition to transport the right fats to the right place and also serve functionally as antioxidants and cellular restorative agents. So I hope this gives you a different perspective about the physiologic function of apolipoproteins than that which you might have had in the past, where you just thought of them as lipid transport agents. So the apolipoproteins become important markers as well as managers of cardiovascular risk. And this was actually described in a Quarterly Journal of Medicine paper back in 2006, volume 99, page 277. And the ratio of apolipoprotein B to apolipoprotein A1 become not only important risk factors for cardiometabolic syndrome, but also important therapeutic targets for how diet, lifestyle, exercise can improve outcome in patients who have dyslipidemia. I'm now quoting from the Journal of Internal Medicine, volume 259, page 462 in 2006. And in metabolic syndrome, the ratio of apolipoprotein B to apolipoprotein A1 becomes a very important risk factor identifier for cardiometabolic risk. This is some wonderful work by Dr. Walios and his colleagues, published again in the Journal of Internal Medicine, volume 255, page 204, in which this ratio of less than 0.6 to 1 of ApoB to A1 is a desirable target for intervention and can be used for following the success of therapy as we try to lower ApoB and increase ApoA1 as indicators of cardiometabolic risk associated with intervention. So this is one surrogate marker, risk factor, analyte that you can use when you're establishing your intervention program and you want to follow it in the patient for how they're proceeding. That's the measurement of their apolipoprotein B to apolipoprotein A1, that's capital A1 ratio. What other analyte has emerged to be very valuable for assessing relative risk of cardiometabolic syndrome and insulin dysregulation? Well, the one that I have found increasing frequency of publications in top-flight journals is lipoprotein-associated phospholipase A2. Sometimes this is called the PLAX test or PLAX test. This is a measurement indirectly of atherogenic inflammatory lesions, the lipoprotein-associated phospholipase A2, or PLACs. I'm now quoting from a recent paper in the journal Circulation that appeared in volume 111, page 570, 2005, that's looking at the Rotterdam heart study and examining the value of measuring lipoprotein-associated phospholipase A2 activity and finding that it was very strongly associated with risk of coronary heart disease and ischemic stroke. The study clearly demonstrated that elevated levels of LPPLA2 activity was an independent predictor of coronary heart disease and ischemic stroke in the general population and might be a very good extended risk factor for vascular disease, particularly for those individuals with inflammatory underlying etiology, because it's measuring inflammatory markers associated with arterial plaque. This is just one of many papers that have identified PLA2 as being a very important independent risk factor. Another paper that you might be familiar with comes from the West Scotland Coronary Prevention Study Group work published in the New England Journal of Medicine. This is volume 343, page 1148 in 2000, where they found that lipoprotein-associated phospholipase A2 was an independent predictor of coronary heart disease beyond that of just cholesterol, HDL, or LDL itself, again, because it provides a strong risk factor assessment for inflammatory arterial endothelial dysfunction. So you might say, how does this compare to hsCRP, the Dr. Robert Ridker extended risk factor for inflammatory connections to atherosclerosis? I think the PLAX test or the PLA2 test, along with the ApoB to A1 ratio and atherogenic particle number and hsCRP, frames a new extended panel for cardiovascular risk factors that evaluates both cholesterol dynamics, lipoprotein physiology, and inflammation simultaneously that can give us a much better trajectory towards functional decrements in cardiovascular function that is modified by hyperinsulinemia. So I would say the lipoprotein-associated phospholipase A2 should be added together with hsCRP, added together with that of the ApoB to A1 ratio analysis. And even as we move forward looking at it as a novel inflammatory biomarker, I think we can say that In fact, I'm actually quoting from a paper in the Journal of Endocrinology and Metabolism that showed that lipoprotein lipase A2 has benefits beyond that of the other traditional risk factors for picking up people who have this underlying inflammatory component. And often I'm asked the question, how do you evaluate more specifically inflammatory potential associated with atherogenic risk and ischemic stroke risk? And I would put the lipoprotein phospholipase A2 in plasma as another useful tool for evaluating high risk. This is, by the way, the paper I'm quoting from, Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, is volume 90, page 3100 in 2005. So more and more papers being published on this important area. Similarly, paper in 2006 issue of the Arterial Sclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology Journal showing the same things, that it predicts future cardiovascular risk in patients. And I think we can say that we're witnessing the emergence of a profound new extended risk factor that allows better assessment of vascular inflammatory potential. So I've talked here about the use of the ApoB to A1 ratio for cardiometabolic syndrome and its relationship to hyperinsulinemia. I've talked about hsCRP. I've talked about now the phospholipase A2 assessment. Another one that's obviously receiving a lot of attention is carotid IMT, intramedial thickness. And that appears to be another very important early assessment tool for evaluating general systemic atherogenic processes that is early on able to be seen prior to the more serious pathology. And there is a variation of this measurement of carotid IMT that may provide even more early warning assessment, and that's brachial artery reactivity, which is flow-mediated dilation. And some of you probably know how this procedure is done. A sphygmomanometer cuff, a blood pressure cuff, is put on the arm. It's pumped up to produce occlusion for a temporary period of time. It's released very rapidly, and then blood flow is measured downstream from this occlusion. And it's a measurement then of endothelial reactivity, endothelial nitric oxide output, vasoreactivity. And it has a very useful functional evaluative application to endothelial health. And as we all recognize, cardiovascular dysfunction starts at first as endothelial cell dysfunction, principally through alterations in ENOS activity, redox potential at the endothelial cell, and inflammatory potential that results. So this flow-mediated dilation, which you can do if you have an IMT machine, becomes another very important functional tool for evaluating cardiovascular patency or health early on prior to the onset of pathology. And interestingly enough, a number of studies have been done and published showing that by intervention with diet and lifestyle that you can improve flow-mediated dilation very rapidly in 6 to 12 weeks in patients that undergo intervention, including nutritional intervention. There's a paper that's been published looking at intervention with various types of fruits and vegetable concentrates and the improvement of flow-mediated dilation in patients that have altered endothelial function prior to taking each day a concentrate of fruits and vegetables. This was, I think, a very interesting study that helped us to understand the usefulness that this technology might have in being able to pick up changes in endothelial function in the arterial system through dietary intervention. Similarly, an interesting study looking at flavonoid-rich dark chocolate improving endothelial function and increasing vascular flow was shown in a study using flow-mediated dilation. This is work out of a group at Tufts University Medical School, published in the Journal of American College of Nutrition, volume 23, page 197 in 2004. We also know that if you give people high-fat meals and you do flow-mediated dilation, you show decreased endothelial function. And then if you supplement the meal with walnuts and or olive oil, you can see restoration of improved function in their flow-mediated dilation, their vascular endothelial function. This was actually published in the Journal of American College of Cardiology, volume 48, page 1666 in 2006. We also know that L-arginine supplementation has demonstrated improved endothelial function when given at 6 to 10 grams a day and measured in individuals using flow-mediated dilation as the treatment intervention. This is in the Journal of Applied Physiology in 2006. And even epigallocatechin gallate, or ECGC, that's involved as a composition of green tea, has been shown to improve endothelial function by examination through this flow-mediated dilation technology. So if you have access to an IMT machine to measure with Doppler sonography the flow and the intimal thickness, then you can also do this flow-mediated dilation technology and evaluate early on some of the changes that are occurring in people's vascular endothelium by intervention with either diet, lifestyle, or medications. We've also shown and has been published that you'll see improvement in endothelial function through flow-mediated dilation studies after glitazone therapy in people with insulin resistance, and that even in metabolic syndrome, by improving insulin sensitivity, you see improved flow-mediated dilation response. So I think that this is a very interesting new advancing frontier as it relates to this story about how we would assess functional aspects of the vascular system that respond from mechanisms of action that are occurring upstream through altered endocrine, inflammatory, and immune-related functions. Now, how does this all translate clinically? Let's just kind of take a deep mental breath here for a second and ask, what does this really translate to clinically? What we're really saying is that when we analyze a patient's plasma or serum for various analytes, and we look at markers such as cholesterol or LDL cholesterol or HDL cholesterol or triglycerides, that we're really measuring a functional status of how those lipids are being transported around the body out of various sites where they're biosynthesized to delivery into other cells at a distance or tissues at a distance like the artery wall, and that that transport occurs on the backbone of molecules that have the personality and responsibility for making these fats soluble in the blood, which is water, that are called apolipoproteins, and that this synthesis of the various apolipoproteins, these transport molecules, is reflective of the overall state function of that individual, both how their genes make these apolipoproteins, that means their genetic history, and how the stimulation of the genes by environmental signals trigger the genes to produce these transport molecules. So again, it's genes and environment. So if a family has a familial hypercholesterolemia, they have the genes that both synthesize cholesterol or triglycerides at higher levels, and they may also have genes that increase the production of these transport apolipoproteins. That's a genetic situation. Beyond that, then, are the environmental factors that influence the synthesis of these transport agents and the lipids, which for most people that have elevated blood cholesterol and triglyceride levels, it's not the specific genes that control this, like hardwired. It's the environmental factors that modulate gene expression that induce then the hyperlipidemia. So then we say, well, what are the environmental factors? I mean, what are the modifiable things? How do we think functionally, a systems biology approach towards this? And we look then at things that increase inflammatory potential, things that increase immunological dysregulation. This could be allergies, toxins, infectious agents, microbiological agents that induce an altered immune function. And then lastly, obviously, we would look at things like environmental agents, toxic chemicals that might alter various redox processes within the liver that then cause alterations in the synthesis of these apolipoproteins and then transport lipids differently to arterial cell walls. So if we put all of this together, I think we're led into recognizing that it's not so simple just to take a number and say, oh, the number is high, let's just deliver an agent to lower that number. What we should really be doing is looking at the environment in the context of that patient as to what might be the signals that they are receiving at the genetic level, the liver, that is modulating lipoprotein synthesis and lipid synthesis and creating these things that we see as elevations or reductions in certain lipoproteins. Insulin is one of those surrogate markers or signaling molecules that influences the synthesis of these molecules. And therefore, if you have hyperinsulinemia, meaning a higher circulating level of insulin than normal is required to cause uptake of glucose and glucose transport, that's one of those effects of higher insulin is activity of gene expression that regulates and alters your apolipoprotein levels. Therefore, we said metabolic syndrome, hyperinsulinemia, is associated with altered levels of ApoB to A1. Increasing ApoB decreasing apolipoprotein A1. So that becomes a marker that can be used as a tool for evaluating related insulin signaling function. Now, would this therefore be something that every person should routinely have done? It's an expensive analyte. If you don't have to do it, why should you do it? Why should you put ApoB and A1 in your panel? I would say that based on this study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in the fall of 2007, which didn't define a higher specificity of the ApoA1 to B ratio as being of advantage over normal cholesterol HDL, suggests that for general garden variety assessment that it's probably not cost effective to include the ApoB to A1 ratio. But for patients who have evidence of insulin resistance with an elevated triglyceride, low HDL, then I think that inclusion of the ApoB to A1 ratio is valuable because it tracks so closely with relative risk to cardiometabolic dysfunction. As you probably know, cardiac disease associated with insulin resistance is one of the major risk factors. So I think the ApoB to A1 ratio becomes effective and important there. The companion to this is what we call the atherogenic particle size and particle number. And there are a number of laboratories that do this now as another cardiovascular risk factor determinant, where you look at both the atherogenic dense particles and their size and number. This can be done as by NMR or by other technologies, whereby you get a particle number and atherogenic index. That can be coupled together with your ApoB to A1 ratio to better define relative physiological function that can be seen later as associated with focal inflammation of the artery wall, so you get a higher calcium score and you get higher atherogenic risk. We're going back in time, aren't we, looking at earlier warning progressive signs before we get to acute pathology and we get into a defined disease state. We're looking at ways to intervene and track successive intervention early. So by going earlier, it requires a less hard-hitting intervention, which then implies that we would get more benefit if we were earlier on by doing diet and lifestyle intervention. So early warning, milder intervention, better improved function. That's the strategy relative to waiting much later in the sequence of events where pathology starts to develop. We get a atheromatous plaque, it's fibrous, it's got a fibrous cap on it. Now we have a whole different thing about stable versus unstable plaque, which is a different concern than if we were to catch this earlier and have a much less aggressive need for intervention, meaning stenting or bypass or more aggressive pharmacotherapy. So I think that the use of such things as the ApoB to A1 ratio, the lipid particle size and number, things like hsCRP, and the PLA2 or plaques test become all very important parts of our understanding of defining relative risk and then tracking a patient on intervention to see how these parameters improve over time. And over time means 6 to 12 weeks. Generally, that's how long it takes by diet and lifestyle intervention to start seeing a demonstrable improvements in these analytes. So a 6 to 12 week intervention using a Mediterranean-style diet, regular exercise program, stress management, obviously smoking cessation. Now we start to provide alternatives, phytochemical-rich diets that modulate these intracellular signaling processes that are associated with inflammation and oxidative free radical pathology. This all becomes the standard for a functional medicine early warning intervention. I hope this has put this in some context for you, because often we're confronted in this field with the question, what tests are cost effective? I mean, obviously, if we were to put the whole kitchen sink behind an analysis, the bill for evaluation could run in the tens of thousands of dollars. So you have to ask, what are the most cost effective evaluative tools for a functional assessment? And how do you layer these on? You want to start with the least expensive profile to begin with. And then as additional questions become more of concern, then you start adding more tests to get more specificity. My suggestion is by starting with a standard lipid profile, doing anthropometric evaluation of waist-to-hip ratio, looking at the traditional metabolic syndrome risk factors, looking at blood pressure, looking at elevated triglyceride HDL ratio, and looking at elevated uric acid levels in the blood. If all of these things demonstrate a trajectory towards metabolic syndrome, like your triglyceride HDL ratio is above 4 to 1, you have marginally elevated triglyceride levels, You've got GGTP levels that are in the upper level of normal. That's gamma glutamyl transpeptidase levels in the upper level of normal. You've got some marginal elevation of ALT or AST suggesting a non-alcoholic fatty liver disorder. You've got increased central adiposity and increased marginal systolic and diastolic blood pressure increases. Now you say, well, this patient really has all these risk factors for metabolic syndrome. I want to track the success of intervention by utilizing something that's sensitive to the major concern, which is cardiac risk. So now you might then layer on the ApoB to A1 ratio test and also the atherogenic dyslipidemia type of inflammatory test using plaques and the carotid IMT test and the peripheral vasal occlusion test that I've talked about, the use of brachial artery occlusive test. All of these become then different layers of functional assessment that one can employ to both design personalized intervention and to follow the success of therapy. Now, when we put this all together, it obviously then suggests that we're having a systemic influence from hyperinsulinemia and dyslipidemia. It's not just a localized effect on the vasculature. And the systemic effect is because these signaling molecules, like insulin, affect gene expression in multiple tissue types, not just solely on that related to diabetes or cardiovascular disease. And that's why looking at a whole body assessment and taking the functional medicine assessment, which, as you know, is antecedents, triggers, mediators, resulting in signs and symptoms, becomes a different strategy for patient workup than just looking for the differential diagnosis. So we want to start looking at a variety of different signs and symptoms from a detailed personal health history, a good physical examination, a good family history, so that we start piecing together this puzzle of antecedents, triggers, mediators, resulting in the signs and the symptoms that the patient presents with. And the signs and the symptoms are related to these multi-organ types of observables that come from a very good physical and history. So it comes back not relying on laboratory, but relying on the art of being a good observer, of using the brain as a device to develop patterns. Our brain is more capable of doing that than the best of supercomputers. So we're taking in multiple data, collecting it, analyzing it, processing it through our skilled observer status, and then coming from that to an understanding of where that patient appears to lie on this trajectory of risk associated with things like dysfunctional insulin signaling or hyperinsulinemia. And that's why this interview that we're going to move to next is so important, because when we have this web of interconnectedness that becomes our basis for doing a physical and health history and assessment, it takes us into areas that are outside our normal disciplinary myopia. It recognizes that organs aren't just cut off at the boundaries of that organ. They're interconnected through signaling molecules to all other organs. And that's why our discussion with our clinician of the month, Dr. Valerie Treloar, is, I think, so important, because as a dermatologist, her lens that she sees the world through has a lot to do with the skin and its integrity and function. And as you know, it's going to be influenced very heavily by the same signaling molecules that other organs of the body are affected. The inflammatory mediators like TNF-alpha, IL-6, interferon gamma, and how these ultimately then influence cell replication and inflammation processes that pop up on the cutaneous portion of our body that may be reflective of what's going on systemically. And insulin and hyperlipidemias all relate, as you know, to alterations in skin integrity. Look at xanthomas, for instance, with familial hypercholesterolemia. There's a good example of the fatty deposits under the skin as an extreme example. But well before that, we see many different cutaneous examples of dysfunctional signaling, inflammation, and hyperinsulinemia. And with that in mind, it's a good time to move to our clinician of the month, Dr. Valerie Treloar. Let's turn to slide 2. Well, once again, we're at that very look forward to portion of our functional medicine update, which is our clinician of the month. And I'm really excited this month to have a board certified dermatologist who is really a functional dermatologist. In fact, her clinic is integrative dermatology. So in its own title gets the definition. And this is Dr. Valerie Treloar, who is going to be our complimentary COM for the month, our clinician of the month. And I'd like to, in introducing her,
talk a little bit about her background through the eyes and words of a colleague, Dr. Bill Danby, who is Section of Dermatology, Department of Medicine at Dartmouth University, who's recently been nice to write the foreword to Dr. Talora's book, which I think is a mandatory reading, called The Clear Skin Diet, that's been recently published. And I think this, if I can be so bold as to kind of abstract from his foreword, will give you a sense as to how remarkable Dr. Talora is in this whole field of integrative dermatology. He goes on to say that it's a high compliment to be asked to write a foreword, and of course, as he's gone down his path of discovery, he's gotten more and more interested about the concept of diet and how it interrelates with dermatological function, and I'm kind of paraphrasing. And all this, he says, led me eventually to approach with considerable trepidation the high priest of nutritional epidemiological studies, who we've interviewed on this FMU in the past, Dr. Walter Willett, who has, as you know, the Frederick John Stare Professor of Epidemiology and Nutrition at the Department of Nutrition, Harvard School of Public Health. And he goes on to say, I think I detected some incredulity during our initial meeting, but for reasons we've never discussed, he must have wondered if there was something to it, because he assigned Clement Abademo, a postdoctoral fellow, to the work. And after a lot of heavy lifting, Clement had his Doctor of Science, had a 30-year-old question answered, and the association between milk and acne was proven to me. And the word association is important because we're all puzzling over the molecular mechanisms involved. But the original work has led further, and following my presentation on the subject to the Massachusetts Academy of Dermatology a few years ago, Dr. Val Treloar quietly presented herself, and we got talking and talking and talking. I found that Val, partly because of her additional training, but more out of a deep and abiding interest, has an encyclopedic knowledge of the relationship of foods to our most important hormonal and inflammatory processes. This extends far and away beyond my grasp, and, as she points out, far beyond what is taught or learned by today's and even yesterday's medical students. So I think that's a wonderful introduction to Dr. Treloar and what she brings to us today on Functional Medicine Update. So, Valerie, welcome to a Functional Medicine Update. And I guess the first question is, how does a dermatologist end up becoming an integrative dermatologist and having gone through the Applying Functional Medicine and Clinical Training Practice program and being and a leader in functional medicine in this field? It's kind of an interesting path.
I owe it all to you, Jeff. I'm sure you've heard this story. My story is the same one that you hear over and over again, that after 10 years in clinical practice, I was really getting kind of frustrated with the limitations of my conventional dermatology toolbox for my patients with their chronic disease. And I started gently looking outside of the box and was handed the 20-day elimination diet. What doctor in their right mind would read a book with such a title? But I was really astonished by what I read in that book, and then went and signed up to take the AFMCP. It was the last one that was offered on long weekends in two consecutive months, and I made the transcontinental trip twice, October and November of the year 2000, and became more and more convinced and amazed as I went through the AFMCP, really came to the epiphany that I had a whole new toolbox to offer my patients. So I then, of course, had to go and study a little bit and bought a few nutrition textbooks. My kids were away at camp that summer. I would get up early before my work day and spend a few hours plowing through the textbooks, sat for the certifying exam in the American College of Nutrition, and really turned into a PubMed nerd, because I was delighted to discover that there was this whole parallel universe of science and nutrition applied to cutaneous disease. And granted, much of it is biochemical and animal models and cell culture. There's not a large volume of human double-blinded, placebo-controlled, randomized trials, but really did feel a discussion with my patients when I told them that the biochemistry, the physiology made a lot of sense, and that I really thought that we were taking very little risk by improving diets and prudent nutrient supplements, and that we might get a real benefit. My patients were, many of them, wide open to this approach, and they were as frustrated as I was with having been through the whole mill of conventional treatments with not much response. And I've really had that wonderful experience that a lot of us have of being exhilarated by the new ways that we can help people and some really life changes that we can help people go through.
When I look at your background, it reminds me of the road less traveled, as I guess they say. It's a more difficult path, obviously, for people to have done what you've done, having a Bachelor of Science from the University of Michigan, then your medical doctor degree from Boston University, then your residency at the VA in Boston and Tufts University, and research fellowship with the Syntex Dermatology Research Fellowship, and then all of your years of clinical experience as a staff dermatologist at Harvard University Health Service, at the Marino Center for Progressive Medicine, in private practice in Wellesley and now Newton, Massachusetts. That's a lot of years that one might say, well, that could really put you instead to be an excellent traditional dermatologist. But then you add on top of that all these other things that you're talking about that have to come from this internal drive to be a seeker, to at some personal sacrifice, obviously, both in time and I would probably say maybe even money in the end, an aspiration to seek out and do better. What drives a person like you to this? What's the motivation?
Well, I think it is this whole idea of dreading certain patients darkening your door because you really are scrambling at the bottom of your toolbox and you're kind of running out of things, and then suddenly to have that now overflowing with new tools. And there's a lot of creativity, I think, to it. We as clinicians really recognize all that biochemical individuality is so real, that our patients are unique, and the art of medicine is exploring variations in treatment options to find the right match for the right patient. And you've often spoken about the mythical average 70-kilogram man not being really representative of the vast majority of our patient population. So it really does come from recognizing that people are different and you need to explore variations on treatment options to deal with that biochemical individuality.
You know, there are three fields of healthcare that always struck me as being very interesting first-level understandings of functional medicine from what we see in the patient and as it contrasts to things that might be buried deep within the anatomy like internal medicine. And those are ophthalmology, dentistry, and obviously dermatology. But as you talk to the traditional people in those professions, the ophthalmologist or the dentist or the traditional dermatologist, they may not see what they are dealing with every day as being connected to the rest of the body, so they may not think of the eyes as being kind of a window into the overall physiological status of the patient, or what's going on in the hard and soft tissue of the mouth as being related to other systemic factors, or in the case of dermatology, the skin being an excretory organ, a vital barrier influence that has relationships to all these other functions. So when you talk to your colleagues, how do you get them to see this broader functional aspect of dermatology?
That a lot of my colleagues really enjoy being reminded about the basic science and biochemistry behind the diseases that we deal with. In dermatology in particular, because we're so good at describing what we see and it's been a descriptive field for so long, we all recognize that, those of us who are clinicians anyway, that when we give a patient a name to their disease, much of the time we're not telling them anything. One of my favorite conditions to discuss with my patient is a rash called periorificial dermatitis. And I say to him, oh, yeah, you have periorificial dermatitis. It's pink, it's scaly, little bumpy around the mouth, the nares, and around the eyes. And they go, oh, what is that? And I say, yeah, it's, you know, it's a rash around the eyes, nose, and the mouth, you know, so we've given it a great name. Do we have any idea why it happens? What we can, you know, we have some approaches that basically have been empirically tried over the years that seem to be helpful, but I don't know why it's happening to you. And my colleagues, we all share that frustration of, yeah, I can give it a name, but, you know, don't ask me what that means because I'm not really sure why it's happening to you now. And what's fun about functional medicine is that you have the whole matrix to start exploring what has changed in your life that may have been relevant to causing this to suddenly at this point in your life become a problem. And the nice thing about being a board-certified dermatologist is that I can certainly offer them the conventional therapy that seems to be helpful at suppressing those symptoms and knocking them down. But at the same time, we can explore what seemed to turn the processes on so that they will be less reliant on their medications. And my colleagues, a lot of them, are open to the question. They really understand that we don't know what's going on for a lot of the diseases that we're very good at describing. And it is an interesting puzzle, and I think a lot of us go into dermatology because we like puzzles. There's a lot of contact dermatitis, so you get to explore what's happening in the environment to bring that on. And I think that a lot of people find it intriguing.
So that's a wonderful segue, actually, into the first thing that the reader of your book, Clear Skin Diet, A Nutritional Plan That Works, is exposed to, and that's the quote that you have offered, which is, "This book is dedicated to the medical professionals and scientists who continue to think outside the box. Thanks for demonstrating that the only myth concerning acne and diet is that which states there is no connection between the two." That's a very provocative introduction. So tell us a little bit, if you would, about how you have teased apart and understand this connection between diet and acne.
I have to give credit to my co-author, Alan Logan, who truly did the bulk of the writing and is certainly the one who came up with that, as you say, provocative comment. He actually had a few more comments that I think would have been taken by my colleagues as somewhat insulting. And one of the things that he and I did together as we rewrote the book was calm down the rhetoric a little bit, and that was done in part because I want my colleagues to see this as a resource. When Alan and I started looking at this material, we found that we had come to the same position, starting from very different places. He's a naturopathic physician. I'm a board-certified dermatologist with an interest in nutrition. And we had found all the same papers. We had found all the same references. And when we sat down and started talking, we realized that we really had a kernel of truth in here. And we're really excited about providing the information not only to patients for whom I think it's really useful, hopefully, but also as a place for our colleagues to go to really sort of begin to understand why the biochemistry physiology of nutrition truly has an impact on the pathophysiology of acne. And so it's quite heavily referenced. I find that a lot of us have a tendency to do this in functional medicine. When we try to write for the public, we reference a little more heavily than is comfortable for most of our readers who are patients, hoping that they will show it to their doctors, and their doctors will look and see that there is some compelling evidence to support the approach.
So I notice that you've done a really nice job in the book, as I read it, in taking very complex functional medicine matrix or the web and breaking it down into component parts that can be bitten off and absorbed one at a time. But the thesis that you develop, which I think is very convincing, very compelling, is that if you look at a former clear skin nation, and you use Japan as an example, and look at what's happened to their skin as their diet has changed, that you see very strong epidemiological and statistical changes. Tell us a little about what this Japanese precedent suggests.
I find that to be a fascinating story, and that's one that Alan is particularly good at describing. That's his chapter. He's married to a Japanese woman, spends a lot of time living in Japan, is very connected with the culture there. And I think that the story of the Okinawans, which is pretty well described, is representative of a number of different cultures. It's not just Japan where we've seen that the encroachment of a Western culture, largely a Western diet rich in refined carbohydrates and hydrogenated vegetable oils and other vegetable oils, is associated with an increase in inflammatory disease. It's not just Japan. It turns out that Schaefer really made a clear observation of the Inuit when he was up there in the 60s and the 70s as Western influence really started coming into that area. The Inuit were renowned for their gorgeous, clear complexions and complete lack of acne, and it became very clear that as the kids started eating candy and the sodas and a much more westernized diet started replacing their omega-3 fatty acid protein-rich diet, that the kids started getting acne. It was a very profound, very obvious change to the people who were there during those decades. a similar change could be described in Portugal and was also described in Peru. And the wonderful story that was published in the Archives of Dermatology in the year 2002 with Lauren Cordain as the lead author, and no dermatologists as authors, by the way, most amazing story, was looking at the Aceh and Ketevan people who are still living essentially Stone Age lives with that diet rich in fiber, wild game, small amounts of gathered vegetables and fish, a very omega-3 rich, fiber rich, plant polyphenol rich diet, that these cultures had no acne. And he went on to speculate about how their stable insulin levels, which had been documented, contrasted sharply to the spiking insulin levels that we see with the typical American diet that results from several carbohydrate-rich meals and snacks throughout the day, and that the area under the curve was much higher for insulin, and then speculated about how insulin could perhaps be having an effect on testosterone levels because of a decrease in hepatic production of sex hormone-binding globulins. It was a wonderful article just sort of bringing together some of these observations, very rare observations of the years, about how Western culture seemed to have an influence on acne, or the Western diet seemed to have an influence on acne, sort of beginning the process of pulling it together and trying to figure out what the mechanisms were.
It's very interesting. We had the privilege of interviewing on Functional Medicine Update Dr. Cordain on this whole Paleolithic diet concept a number of years ago, and he had just at that point completed and I think had accepted for publication the article you're referring to. And he was making, as you mentioned, as a non-dermatologist, some observations, but taking that from the observational level and moving it into the clinic, obviously, is kind of the payoff of, it's the proof of the pudding, so to speak. So what you're doing and how you've described it in your book, taking the concept of metabolic syndrome, dysinsulinemia, how that interrelates with hormones that we often say, oh, in adolescence, the reason that boys and girls in adolescence get acne is because they're starting into, if they're a girl, into their menstruating years. If they're a boy, they're starting to develop their testosterone levels, and these are just the natural consequences of their developmental process. But you have seen clinically, obviously, a very different implication of that. It's not just necessarily the natural process of going through that first phase of development in becoming an adult. So could you tell us a little bit about your clinical experience in what some people say is just a natural association of hormones with acne versus the environment genes association with acne?
Oh, we point out to the kids at the very beginning that there are people at all ends of the spectrum. That there are kids, no matter what they eat, are going to have gorgeous, clear skin. And there are kids who are going to do everything we tell them to do, and they're still going to have acne. And that's, again, this biochemical individuality, that's a genetic variability among the kids, but that the vast majority of kids are somewhere in the middle, where diet really does make a huge difference. And because of the name of my practice and the nature of my practice, I get to see a lot of kids who get it, teenagers who really do take some responsibility for their health. And everybody says, oh, teenagers aren't willing to change their diet, but a lot of these kids really are. They're smart. They get it. And we find ways for them to snack that are healthier ways of snacking. So when I have a kid and I sit down with them and we talk about, we go through what is your typical breakfast, lunch, dinner, what do you usually snack on, how well are you sleeping, and how many times a night do you wake up, and on a scale of 1 to 10, what number do you give the stresses that you're experiencing in your life? What kind of exercise are you performing now? Are you playing on a sports team? What other exercises are you doing? We work our way through that, which is one of the worksheets in the back of the book. And the kids and I sit down together and say, okay, here are places where maybe changes would make a difference. And sometimes kids are a little resistant. And I say, look, you can take all this information, do with it whatever you want. But if I told you that if you're one of these lucky people who eliminates dairy from your diet and your acne goes away, is it worth it for you? Most of these kids are saying, yeah, that would be worth it for me. And the other point we make, and Lauren Cordain makes this point in a lot of his books, is if you cheat once a week, you're still 90% compliant, and you're probably still going to have excellent benefit. And a lot of these kids will have a threshold. And this is all, you know, pure speculation on my part, but we explore it individually, and there are kids who, okay, they can have a few dairy products. They can have cheese once or twice a week. They can have ice cream once a week mixed in with their otherwise really healthy diet, and they tolerate it. And that's variable from kid to kid. It really is surprising how quickly you can go through this material with somebody and come up with a few places where they can instigate a few little changes and explore it on their own. And again, because I have the luxury of being able to prescribe, I will also give them some Retin-A. And if they're really inflammatory, nodular scarring, I will put them on an antibiotic to quiet that process down and minimize their scarring while they're incorporating their lifestyle changes. And we almost always are able then to withdraw the antibiotics, continue them on their probiotics to help keep their gut in a healthier state, and find that they, because of the lifestyle changes they've made, no longer require the antibiotics to maintain their control over their acne. So it's a wonderful position to be in to say, okay, we're going to use these powerful tools. They have side effects, so we want you to not rely on them, so we're going to work on the lifestyle changes, which take longer to give you a benefit, but we'll be able to then withdraw the pharmaceutical medications and their risks and leave you with better control of your health.
I'm so impressed with the way that you've contextualized this. The two of you in the book, I think, have found that very difficult to find balance between your clinical experience and your observations and the vast years of observations that you've made, coupled with what the literature is saying and the trajectory. I noticed there's over 300 references that you provide at the back of your book that really document all of these associations from a mechanistic level. It's like the Magna Carta of functional medicine and dermatology. It's really very, very well done. And when you talk about the kind of using the matrix or what we call the functional medicine web, it appears to me that you've really found the way that this applies very nicely into dermatology. I love the chapter on gut function as it relates to dermatological problems with the skin, kind of as a reflection of immune dysfunction and the use of pre and probiotics. Has that been a difficult thing for you to describe to patients, how the gut might connect to the skin?
I don't think so. People know their bodies. I think people pay attention more than we think. And a lot of people will say, well, of course, when you suggest that there's a connection. And, yeah, that does make sense. And a lot of people come to me saying, oh, my God, it's so nice to find a dermatologist who gets it, who validates my impression that when I eat this way, I get better. When I eat that way, I get worse. And as I always say to them, I don't argue with success.
Yeah, that's the proof of the pudding, no question. So this takes us, obviously, to a very pragmatic place, and that is integrative dermatology is a unique title that might raise the eyebrows of those who have some presumption as to what either integrative medicine or functional medicine is, and it also maybe makes it more complicated in terms of how you define fee-for-service and spend the time with your patients. How have you worked all these kind of real-world mechanistic issues out in your practice?
I have to say, I really have a lot of enthusiasm for what I do, a passion about it, really. And my colleagues will comment, you're so passionate about this, and they listen, and I take a page out of your book, and I always stand up in meetings. We have local meetings at our local hospital. We have them in town here in Boston. There are a number of academic monthly meetings. There are regional meetings for the New England Dermatologic Society. And I make a point of standing up. I try to stand up at all of these meetings. I cite references supporting some kind of nutritional intervention for one of the diseases that we're discussing. And I get, for the most part, blank stares, and every once in a while I see people scribbling notes. At every meeting, someone comes up to me and asks for a little more information. And there are people who now recognize me and will come up to me and start asking me questions about their own personal nutrition or some patients in whom they've started exploring. Fish oil is a real favorite these days, and a lot of people are kind of exploring it. So I figure if I have one person scribbling notes from making a statement, which I try to have well supported with the literature. I'm getting someplace. A lot of my colleagues now will say, they have patients who come to them and say, look, doc, you know, isn't there something I can do other than take these medicines? And they will say, I have just the dermatologist for you. And they will send these patients over to me. And those patients and I are a great fit. I think that a lot of my colleagues are very, one of my colleagues says, I'm very happy to have someone who shares their mindset, who I can trust, who I know is well-trained and is not just flying by the seat of their pants, is really using good science to try to make these decisions. So it's happening slowly that people are hearing the message, at least beginning to open their minds a little bit. They're not quite ready to try to incorporate this into their own practice, but they're recognizing that it has value. And that's been real exciting. And it's been since 2000, 8 years, I've been sort of slowly working on them.
So I'd like to acknowledge actually four things that seem to characterize what I've heard you say as to why you are the success and will continue to be a growing success, whereas others in our field may still be aspiring to find this level of success by implementing these concepts in their practice and are finding it awkward. And it seems like there's four things that stand out to me. I'm sure there are more than four, but these are the four that kind of stand out high on the marquee. Number one is you're really hardworking and diligent in your self-education, and you've not taken this lightly. You've taken it like going back to school and saying, I'm going to really become a master to the level that I can of this new body of information, and it's going to require some work and dedication and cooperative, probably in your family, support of this, because time is still 24 hours a day. So that hard work diligence component is one thing that really defines you and I think your success. The second obviously kind of derives out of that, and that is you've used that hard work to get into the primary literature to some extent and ferret out a lot of the science that gives you the supporting documentation beyond your own experience that you can use on your side, both for patient education and for colleague education and maybe even third-party reimbursement education if necessary, about why you do what you do. And it's pretty hard to argue with 300 citations that are all from Tier 1 peer-reviewed literature. So I think the foundation in good science, and hopefully functional medicine and AFMCP provided some part of that in your education. And then three, obviously, is attitude. Anyone that listens to you sees the advocacy and the balance, what I would call your positive affirmation, that there are things that we can do. You're open-minded, you're a seeker, you're an explorer, and you're working cooperatively with your patients, and you're very excited about the advocacy that you can bring to that patient's problems, which, you know, the best sales job is positive attitude and excitement about what you're doing. You certainly bring that. And then lastly, fourth, is all of this is contextualized and balanced, I think. You're not way out there on the limb on extremism. You're using the best tool, which is the basic concept, I think, of functional medicine, the right tool at the right place, you know, getting away from the old maxim of all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail. And it's using the right tool or tools at the right time. And that concept of balance really makes your outcome, I think, ever more successful. So maybe there's some takeaways for all sorts of other listeners beyond that of the field of dermatology, just as to how you're approaching this in your own field so successfully. So as they would say in Australia, good on you. It sounds like you're really doing a magnificent job.
You've been very kind, Jeff, and I want to thank you for giving me this whole new way of looking at my work.
Well, thank you, and I would really recommend to our listeners, because, you know, dermatology is part of what people carry around all the time on their outside and reflects their inside function. I think The Clear Skin Diet, this book that you've co-authored so beautifully with Alan Logan, and that in itself is a very unique combination of a naturopath and a board-certified dermatologist working together collaboratively. I think you brought the best of both worlds into this book. So I want to thank you so much for spending the time with us. I know you got to get to patients, but you've really given a lot of us some pearls to use, so thank you.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye-bye. I certainly hope that you had the same feeling that I had in listening to Dr. Treloar speak about her practice and her journey as a dermatologist. It was just so enriching. It reminds me of why the Institute for Functional Medicine and the whole functional medicine concept was really developed and over the last 17 years, why it's evolved, because it's made up of people like Dr. Treloar who bring this exuberant commitment, I guess, as Dr. David Jones talks about, re-enchantment in medicine to discontinue to strive to do better every day and to bring the full weight of their skills and their thoughts and experience into the practice of healthcare delivery. And you can really feel it, can't you, when you hear her speaking and talking about her experience. One of the topics that she addressed that is in the book, The Clear Skin Diet, in some greater detail, has to do with the gut-skin connection and this whole concept of pre- and probiotics. And isn't it interesting to watch the evolution of this field? It was probably 26 years ago, as I recall, that we first talked about probiotics and gastrointestinal associated lymphoid tissue function, gut immune system, in other words, and how that influences systemic inflammatory markers. And I didn't think at the time we were so far ahead of the pack, but I guess really when you look back a quarter of a century, we were pretty much an early adopter of this concept of looking at the gut from a different perspective, from a functional perspective as part of the immune system and how that influences the brain, the liver, the systemic circulating white cells, and ultimately every cell in the body. And I'm very pleased to see that recently the Cochrane Collaboration, which you probably know as this wonderful group of individuals who have collected together their expertise to evaluate the evidence-based medicine surrounding different types of medical therapies, some of which have to do with what has been traditionally called integrative medical therapies or complementary alternative medical therapies or maybe even functional medicine therapies. And within that domain are some of the Cochrane Collaboration reviews of the effects of probiotics on gastrointestinal function and gastrointestinal disease. And we might have thought 25 years ago when we first talked about this on Functional Medicine Update that this was not within the purview of traditional medicine, but it's starting to actually be able to fulfill the criteria of support from groups like the Cochrane Collaboration. So I'd like to just quickly review what recently they talk about in their probiotics for maintaining the remission of inflammatory bowel disease and Crohn's disease. You can find this actually in the 2007 publications of the Cochrane Collaboration, and this review is part of what you can find on www.thecochranelibrary, that's T-H-E-C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E library.com. So that's all one word, thecochranelibrary.com, and under the concept of Crohn's disease and probiotics. So as we review this meta-analysis, we're coming to recognize this systematic review has taken us into a different level of support for this gut-immune connection to gut flora and how that influences local and systemic immunological factors. So I think it's a very, very interesting examination of this emerging view for how probiotics and prebiotics might influence gastrointestinal function and systemic inflammation. So they talk about Saccharomyces boulardii, which has received more and more attention as a potential useful therapeutic probiotic for the management of inflammatory bowel disease. They go on to say, however, if you looked at all the studies that have been published in the peer-reviewed literature, you're not led to recognize that there is just an overwhelming support of probiotics in and of themselves in isolation as being therapeutically successful. In fact, they go on to say there's no evidence to suggest that probiotics are beneficial for the maintenance of remission of Crohn's disease unless there have been other things done. And so these are more complementary types of interventions. And that's, of course, the functional medicine model, that it's not magic bullets. It's not one thing. It is changing diet. It's intervening with the appropriate therapeutic support agents. And it's the best medicine, so to speak. And that's what Dr. Treloar was obviously talking about. So often, I think we tend to think of some of these interventions as being green medicines, as silver bullets. We just do this instead of that. So we give probiotics instead of antibiotics or probiotics instead of sulfasalazine. What we really should be looking at, as Dr. Treloar so beautifully stated in her presentation, is the use of these agents in combination as a consequence of the way we have evaluated that patient through the functional medicine matrix and personalized their therapy. So they may be on antibiotics. They may be on immunoreactive compounds. They are also going to have to eat, and so we're tailoring the diet correctly. We're giving them adjunctive nutrients where possible. We're re-inoculating the bowel using the 4-R program, and the objective is to use as little medicine as possible for as short a duration as possible while trying to improve, obviously, the rate of recovery and the prevention of recidivism or relapse. So I think that the studies that are often done, unfortunately, use agents just one at a time as kind of single agents against these diseases. And then we go back and we say, oh, the research doesn't support the use of probiotics in inflammatory bowel disease, or the research doesn't support the use of probiotics for managing insulin resistance, or the research doesn't indicate that probiotics are good for hepatocellular injury and inflammatory liver disease. And that's because some of this research was done isolated, one agent at a time, rather than looking at the complex of that agent, in this case pre and probiotics, in the combination of a personalized therapy for the patient. And obviously the reason that we don't have the data is it's very difficult to design these studies to look at combination therapies and do it in stratified ways that are individualized to the patient. So you start saying, well, gee whiz, we can't even find a methodology to prove our hypothesis. So you have to use inferential information, you have to use case studies, you have to use animal studies, you have to use epidemiological work, you have to use intervention trials that have cohort analysis that have demonstrated the success. In other words, it's the combination of information together that paints a picture towards support of improved patient outcome rather than kind of a one agent against one outcome variable. So the Cockburn collaboration evaluation, to me, shows that there is definitely benefit to probiotics, but we can't unequivocally state that it is the magic bullet for Crohn's disease or inflammatory bowel disease as a single agent intervention against placebo. And once again, that calls for, in my mind, the kind of approach that Dr. Treloar was describing, which is a functional medicine approach that uses a combination of variables for managing the patient's topography of their dysfunction or their disease, the architecture of their disease, which is more than just one agent influencing physiological function. And it requires more than one agent then to normalize their function. So I believe that this is a very nice specific example of a more general theme that you heard from her presentation about how to look at a whole organism as it pertains to a dermatological condition and say that the dermatological condition is a reflection of an imbalance in the whole organism. Now let's look within the functional medicine matrix as where those imbalances may reside in that patient, be it insulin or stress hormones or food allergies or gut dysbiosis or imbalanced dietary intake of various agents or omega-6, omega-3 fatty acid imbalances. You start looking at that full mosaic to design the program that's individualized to the patient. From that, then, becomes the treatment of choice and ultimately the best medicine for that patient. So thank you very much for your attention. And really, once again, thanks, Dr. Treloar, for her very, very high skills in communicating how functional medicine works in a dermatological practice. We'll look forward to sharing with you next month.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis, LLC by Dr. Jeffrey Black. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.